Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 129, where Pedro, Rowan, and Tom are applying an organizational lens to the Private Snafu training video series commissioned by the U.S. War Department during 1943 to 1945. In part two, we will discuss the importance and challenges of socializing organizational policies and procedures through the use of training media. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
One thing that our discussion in part one made me think of was how this Snafu character, towards the end we were discussing how, regardless of, let's say, the content of a given clip, which has benefits, and we talked about humor benefits, we talked about animation-related benefits, but also the character itself has a kind of almost emotional message to it. That got me thinking about the role of emotions in socialization, and a lot of, let's say, what we might all think of today when we think of organizational socialization. One, it's more, of course, information heavy, when I do trainings at least. Two, they do try to bring in some of this infotainment. So if it's something about phishing scams and being careful with your passwords, there nowadays there's a little video and they show like a mini burglar trying to steal stuff from your table, at least some of the trainings I've seen. So there's a bit of this coming in, but what I don't see is a leveraging of the emotional side of things. So, even when we talk about socialization from, let's say, an identity perspective, if you're a lawyer or a banker or a doctor, that's yet another perspective. But what Snafu reminded me of is the idea of socializing, almost a negative socialization of like, oh, you don't want to be that guy or that person, which is interesting to think about.
I guess some of the choices really do depend on what kind of a policy or what kind of a procedure are you trying to impart. Is it a behavior that you want to squash out? I mean, I suppose there's like a couple of different ways of approaching it. The infotainment is you put up the act perpetrated by somebody who is the object of ridicule. Don't be that person because that person is stupid and you are not stupid, so you won't do that. Now, in the U.S. Armed Forces, we have television networks that are scattered around the globe. The Armed Forces Radio and Television Service. They do not show commercials. They instead show commercial spots that are produced that are performed the exact purpose as Snafu. And some of them are very similar in nature. They're infotainment specifically to try to drive home, like, for example, don't give up secrets. It's some of the same thing, although usually done by actors or whatever. Those kind of spots, they've lingered on over time, and they still kind of use that same motif of trying to, for the negative socialization, don't do this. And then there's sort of like the other one of which you're trying to promote a particular policy. It's like a virtue. So then in that particular case, then your aim is to try to bump up the reader to say, you are a great person. Great persons do these things. So you will do these things as an approach. And those tend to be less infotainment and much more practical, realistic, because now you're trying to situate the person as somebody in the organization who is doing the right thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I think the other thing it depends on is not just what behaviors, but what motivations underlie those behaviors that you're hence targeting that, let's say, flavor of behavior through your socialization. So let me make that concrete. If the behavior you're trying to target is leaking secrets, for example, there's one flavor of that or one motivation underlying that, which is literally malintent. So if you're a spy, so a spy isn't going to be socialized away from leaking secrets just because of videos or information. The other motivation / flavor is the other end of the spectrum that says you're ignorant. So you are actually clueless. You had no idea that this could have been stolen, etc. that sometimes just information could also work. Again, if I think about some of the trainings I've done for like phishing emails, knowing that, oh, when I put my cursor, just hover it over the link, it tells me where it's headed. And so I can kind of foresee that. Just the information, I was ignorant of the information. So the information has enough power to change my behavior. What they're targeting with Snafu is in between that, which is not necessarily pure ignorance or malice on the other end, but more carelessness, where you need to be aware that you're doing something wrong and then you need to stop doing that. And that's where this emotional socialization works. So an example in recent times is, I think 2-3 years ago, there was it was in the news in the US, someone who, a contractor for the Air Force, had leaked some sensitive information on Discord. And that was just on a Discord kind of game server. And so, similar to Snafu, the motivation there wasn't either strategic leak or complete ignorance that this is sensitive information. The motivation was kind of just showing off to my friends on Discord. And so, similar to Snafu in the Homefront video. And I think that's where this socialization with information plus emotion perhaps is a useful tool to target those kinds of behaviors.
So a quick thing is, I think it's very interesting that somehow the position of assuming ignorance, right, or ignorance of a particular kind and starting on a more baseline level, I think just something I wanted to, you know, repeat from you, Rahin. And then thinking about socialization and emotions, I think that the point here is also that shaming is also part of socialization. And I was thinking back in the episode, I think it's episode 38, the one that we read, Van Manen on police socialization, right? He has his, you know, work. I don't remember what is the typology of cops and the kind of behaviors, but clearly there are behaviors that are seen as not worthy, or some behaviors more worthy than others, right? What kind of things, what kind of cop is you're expected to be, right? And we can, you know, go all the way to more, let's say, toxic/abusive work settings, in which, I don't know, imagine a very stereotypical investment banking type of Wolf of Wall Street kind of thing, that would be people that would be publicly shamed, right? Because they don't make as much money, they're not as good as the trading, and so on. So we can also have places that either in a more indirect, gentle way have some kind of stereotype of the professional worker, employee, manager, whatever you don't want to be, all the way to people that, as part of the socialization, ostracize and push out people. So it differentiate people and show consequences on kind of behavior that you do and what is considered by the group as more or less worthy.
And that's a powerful thing in multiple contexts. So I immediately thought of, you know, far removed from military, but in the academic arena, right? So if you're a first year PhD student sitting in a seminar, being, you know, speaking up but asking a question that is seen as dumb is a powerful motivator to kind of wait, see what kinds of questions other people are asking. I remember I used to, there was some seminar on kind of power and status, but specifically from a social psychology perspective. And throughout my mind, it was just, the question was more about, wait, aren't these, the way you're defining them, aren't they the same thing? Or this doesn't make sense. But I didn't ask because no one else is asking and I don't want to seem stupid. And then in the case of science, what that socialization process achieves is, later on, let's say in year two, if I am to ask a question about power and status, it will probably be a within paradigm question. And I might be now teasing our next episode on Thomas Kuhn, but we would be socialized into taking for granted that this is what power means and this is what status means in this, for these scholars, let's say social psychologists. And so then you start asking questions that are kind of within paradigm and within the socialization norms over time. And the motivation, again, similar to Snafu, is you just don't want to be seen as dumb.
Yeah. Now, this kind of raises the question of, what do you socialize and what do you not socialize? Like, and when I mean by socialize in that context is, what do you put into a deliberate socialization program versus what do you exclude? And there's a couple of motivations behind this. First, there's kind of like the tendency for mandatory training to increase in quantity and time commitment just naturally because organizations do want to ensure that their policies are understood. Policies tend to be many, and there's always this sense of whoever is the proponent of a particular policy wants to make sure that it's in the socialization packet so that everybody gets everything and we don't have to worry about all the newbies, these newbies coming in and messing things up. But on the other hand, of course, time is limited. And when we start talking about this, the form, some forms of delivery, like you think about 4 minutes in a snafu video to deliver a single message. But if you're trying to lay out a policy about, you know, proper use of information technology, which I'm sure just about every organization in the entire world has some version of that, you're talking about regulations upon regulations upon regulations. And you're trying to put out about 200 bits of information, I may be exaggerating, in the span of less than an hour. And by the time that it accumulates, you realize that you simply don't have enough time to do everything. And you're forced to use much more efficient means of delivery. You can't make them as effective infotainment anymore. They almost turn into death by PowerPoint done by video. I don't know if you've all have ever experienced mandatory training that is of that nature. We can have some good questions as to whether or not that is effective, but at least it sort of serves a bureaucratic check the box function that the organization can say, we trained you, so if you screw up, it's your fault, that sort of thing.
Yeah, firstly, I've definitely been through those kinds of videos myself. I do think there's some distinction to be made here, though, between training and socialization, where socialization is this broader kind of attitude of I want, like, you know, loose lips sink ships. So I'm not training you on what information is sensitive or not, or what the levels of classification are and throwing a barrage of information at you. I'm just socializing you into being someone who keeps mum, who's just tight-lipped by nature. Similarly, so this idea of what do we socialize versus not, I think socialization is more of this, you want a general attitude such that let's say if it's to do with cybersecurity in the organization, if I'm socialized into just being someone who's wary about these things, then at a given point in time when I need the information, I can probably still pull it up from our IT policy, or, you know, in the future, probably there'll be an AI chatbot that I can just query about the policy. But policy it's a whole host of information, and that would need to be passed on through training, versus socialization is more to do with this kind of changing your orientation itself towards certain things. And then the other thing in terms of what to socialize versus not is like what to deliberately, let's say, socialize through training versus what gets socialized in a more day-to-day, for example, the seminar, what kinds of questions we ask, I think is more to do with also the frequency of the underlying behavior. So let's say a cyber attack hopefully doesn't happen frequently enough. So you need to socialize through training or some of these snafu examples as well, versus the example of what's the right norm for question asking in an academic seminar happens frequently enough that the socialization happens just by way of showing up at your job, essentially.
And this opens a different, two dimensions. One is that socialization is continuous, right? And I think that is an interesting thing, is that there is, of course, this idea of the more formal, compulsory, structured training, right? So that's one thing. And the socialization that is continually being done, and that's a great example of the snafu shorts, that there were multiple and they were done as part of a routine and, you know, people were constantly reminded. Some of them actually, you know, this whole idea of secrecy was shown in different videos. So some things that are core, call them values, norms, whatever, right, are continuously imparted. And I think that such mechanisms are particularly strong because, as I think Tom was saying in the beginning, if it's a more general behavior, it makes sense that it is a more general instruction, right, that you can apply and think about in different situations versus what you have to do to accomplish your job and doing task A, B, C. The other thing I wanted to unpack is that besides the distinction of, let's say, formal, informal, or continuous, or one-off, or death by PowerPoint, and the use of, you know, comedy, there's an element of multimodality because it's about not just text, it's not just even verbal, right? Some of the shorts were, you know, without words. It's images and visual analogies and sound. And again, in a world saturated by images that we leave and all sorts of, you know, digital connections, I think it's interesting to think beyond just either the written policy or the verbal instruction to see how things apply. And of course, they have always existed. There are, of course, signs in every workplace. Just think about, I don't know, a factory and what the kind of signs that would be about safety. But I think it's interesting to think about also how socialization is done through emotion, so not just rational, but also through a variety of media, not just the written policy and the verbal instruction.
You're definitely hitting on one thing that I was going to ask about, because it is one thing to genuinely and authentically embed the emotions into the message and convey it convincing and effective. But this sense of some of the mandatory training that I've seen here almost tries to force it, where a message that perhaps could be delivered in a very, very simple medium or whatever, there is this belief or a myth that it's got to be wham pow, or nobody will pay attention to it. And you start seeing bells and whistles added, where the bells and whistles actually get in the way.
But this is also a particularly kind of, not uniquely, but still a specially specific case of socialization, because essentially the variable we haven't yet explicitly stated, which is scale, right? So if you're just in the academic department example, it's 10 of you, 20 of you, you don't need to do this kind of come up with a whole new series of cartoons and a character, enduring character, etc. Socialization can just happen amongst the group. If you're a whole university, then often you actually have different cultures, subcultures. You know, the economics department is socialized differently from the marketing or the OB department. And you'll see that again with the running example of seminars. If you're in an economics department seminar versus OB, you'll see different norms at play. So it's, even if the number of employees has increased, this, it's not necessarily a scale in socialization. If you're in a big company, you know, it's different things you want to impart onto the financial control and audit team versus the kind of story writing or creative animation team. But in the case of the army, it's like millions of troops, and for all of them, you want the same messages apply, the same attitudes need to be herded. And so the scale is immense. And so then you have all of this kind of craft of multimodality, of having up the emotional overtone, all of that. It is a bit of a unique problem that the military faces.
It isn't just the military. I think it is government. In government organizations, probably more so than other organizations, there is a sense of a bit more uniformity, or there's an expectation of uniformity that perhaps drives a desire to want to scale. Because there is probably not very much that goes on that couldn't just be handed, for example, to a local unit commander, where you do see a lot of the same differences of socialization from different parts of the military because of the different functions they perform. And there are a lot of subcultures. But you're right that there's much more of a desire to standardize it. And also because people move around, you have this added thing where you almost have to re-socialize every single time you move from one place to another. You know, when we've been talking about the training and socialization, it isn't just institutionalizing socialization when you join the organization. There's systematic reinforcement that is also included, where you end up being re-socialized into a new location when you arrive. And it's a repeat of a lot of what you've already been socialized because of a desire to have it standard and to limit variance.
Yeah, this happens a lot in kind of rotational programs. Here in the NHS, in the UK Health Service, for example, that until you're a consultant, you rotate every 6 months from one hospital to another, let's say within London, for example, or within Northwest London. Similarly, if you worked at GE or 3M, you might be rotating across different divisions. And often you are repeating the same training as you rotate, because it was set up, of course, for a broader purpose than the rotatee's experience. And so yeah, I do think that's an enduring challenge even today. This is a slight slight aside, but I also realized with not just government, but specifically with the military and with the secrecy component, a lot of the socialization implicit in a lot of the Snafu videos is that Snafu himself is just guessing at what's going on to him. You know, in one of the videos, it's, oh, they've given us these shots for tropical diseases, so I guess they're shipping us to the South Pacific. And so a further reason for information control, you see, we talked about it in the rumors episode, or clip rather, you also see it in the censored clip titled Censored. Another reason for socializing this kind of tight-lippedness is because it's not about protecting sensitive information, but it's about preventing misinformation, because the people within the organization are often misinformed or have knowledge of what's going on.
So I want to go beyond corporations and this. It's very interesting, but all of the shorts and all of his debate also made me think that while, of course, the shorts were for the, you know, deployed personnel, because they talk about the home front and because, as I said in part one, there is a sense that everyone matters, right? I think there is something about the collective effort, almost like a mobilization kind of thing. And we talked about that some of the functions of the short can be more instructive and some can be more venting, but across them, I think there is a sense of even a private matters, right? So it's like everyone has to be part and pulling the same direction type of thing. And it's interesting to think that the instrument of cartoons or humor has always been used by social movements, right? How to rail up people, make charges of whatever powerful figures that are being criticized, use all sorts of chants and emotional language, right? In order to get people to care about something, think about something, show up at the square, be involved. And you just thought about, you know, you said misinformation, and people that said misinformation, from what I understand, you know, in social media and everything, they look exactly about all sorts of visual humor, signs and aesthetics and all of this, right, that are used to convey all kinds of messages. So I think there is also a broader thing about how to, not just to socialize employees in understanding something, but how you get large scale, as you're saying, that can go even beyond the military, like large scale mobilization of people, collective effort through those means. And they're the means that we have known from, I don't know, I keep thinking about the French Revolution, because I was just reading some time ago about, you know, the kind of charges that were circulating and all kinds of things at that time. I think that it's also an interesting thing to think about on how that kind of messages have such scale power for good and bad, of course, because then all kinds of information, as Raheem was just saying, can circulate.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And as you were talking, the thing that crossed my mind was the Uncle Sam recruitment posters, which I think is kind of an example of what you're talking about. The people who designed that poster, I believe it was a gentleman who was a meat packer. I may have that wrong, but he was just an ordinary person, and put him into that pose and put it up on a poster, probably had no idea that that image would last the better part of a century because it was successful. And this, I think, you know, sometimes when I've dealt with folks who are in the marketing biz, you know, there's a lot of language that they use that sort of suggests that that is what they're after. You know, they're looking for what is that magic message and the magic conveyance of that message that is going to have incredible lasting value far beyond just, say, the video spot on television that they're doing right now. It's a very, very active business.
And I mean, I would imagine by now they've also, so what Snafu perhaps did implicitly was later made explicit by media theory or communications theory. Marshall McLuhan had the famous phrase, the medium is the message, and so how much the medium matters. So we just talked about Snafu as a, let's say the content of Snafu's character and the plot lines are such that, of course, there's this emotional tone of you don't want to be Snafu. But also the fact that it's a cartoon reiterates that same message that you don't want to be a cartoon. You don't want to be that kind of clown, essentially. If you had the same plot lines, etc., but in a text form or even in a live action video form, it's different from the message that you get through the medium as well.
Now, I'll also bring up another example, which is one that became a running magazine for years. It was called Preventive Maintenance Monthly. And this was an Army magazine that, in a typical maintenance magazine, you can imagine that the content is laden with procedures, a lot of terminology. You know, here's how you fix a fill in the blank, use this tool or whatever. And a way of, to stop it from being mundane, they turned it into not a comic book, but it was just basically an illustrated magazine in which they had several recurring characters who were stereotypes, but they were more realistic looking stereotypes. And I want to say that like Sergeant Half-Mast was your typical square-jawed grunt who adorned a lot of these illustrations. So instead of just giving a message in a text box, it would be put in a bubble spoken by one of these characters. And so the magazine was filled with these illustrations that incorporated the procedures and the requirements and all that sort of thing that would otherwise be very boring into a form that people liked to look through. It drew their attention and people would hold on to these. They would keep them as keepsakes for years. It was that successful. Unfortunately, when the whole print medium kind of dissipated a decade or so ago, they decided to stop producing this. But I bet you I could probably do a Google search right now and you could probably pull up these old magazines. They were actually very well done. They were very simple and very effective. But the illustrations didn't necessarily add anything to the character of to the information. It was just a visual way of trying to make this stuff engaging and accessible. Now, I've got one other aspect about mandatory training nowadays that I think would be worth mentioning since we're talking about potential for use of automation and all that sort of thing. Because in the days of private snafu, like we talked about in part one, what was the measure of effectiveness? How do you know that it actually had an impact? Now, with modern technology, you have the ability to not only use various visual and whatever means to convey the message, but you also have automated tools that allow you to monitor or track who took the training. It is actually in itself turned into its own little bureaucracy by which individuals have to go online, complete the training, complete a quiz that shows that they learned the material, and then upload a certificate to a central database for tracking purposes. And there's reports that are held centrally to see who is keeping up on all of their training requirements and who is not. My, somebody very, very close to me who's now onboarding at a school district is having to do the same kind of a thing where everything is tracked and it's becoming bureaucratized. My question, which is sort of like an open question, is this a good or a bad thing? Is this something that basically takes what should be part of socialization and turning it into just a drudgery?
So since you use the term, I cannot help myself,
I was waiting for this, Pedro. I was waiting for this.
Also because the military is the par excellence, the bureaucracy, right? And I think that's very interesting that some of the shorts are about the rationale of the procedures, right? And we know from the famous paper by Adler and Boris on enabling coercive bureaucracy, the importance of basically, instead of de-skilling, upskilling, using the idea of usability, so you have procedures. In the case, they're studying workflows, are their primary example for the paper, that people understand, there is to use, they understand how it fits the broader system. Basically, it's like, you follow a procedure because you understand the purpose and it's transparent to you. The purpose of all of this that you're describing is basically compliance in the most thin and sad way, right? It's almost like in the sense of de-responsabilization, in the sense of, okay, we trained you, so it's like you're on your own versus are you developing? Are you being educated? Because I think that's the other interesting thing that I saw in the shorts is that we all in our practice, I'm sure, have shown a clip of a movie, right, for our students. So there is also this thing that in a way we can imagine the same way. Of course, they read the stuff and we verbally tell them the concepts, whatever, the analysis, whatever we are doing, but we can also just show a clip to just illustrate that. And I think that adds something to the communication. It's an educational tool. And I think that's a great example of training has been not just bureaucratized, but I think has been almost taken away its spirit, right? Because it's taken away the educational purpose behind, and the machinery in place is set to see whether you completed it versus the extent in which you are able to understand, live by, see that in your practice versus like you just, you know, tick the right box in the quiz. So it's a form of bureaucratization that has the target, a very thin, I think, idea of education, and also somehow has an ultimate goal of just pushing away what would be the role of organizations, which is to, of course, make people part of it and have a sort of unit of direction. The all things that we know that are paramount, you know, organizations are machines to coordinate action to a purpose. It means that people need to feel part and understand the purpose. And we just recorded some weeks ago the episode on purpose about NAS and all of this, right? So that's what good socialization would do, and train people to understand what would make sense to be part of the organization, what should they do, what the skills I need, what should I have to pay attention, what are the tools available, versus, okay, I got this training, so therefore now I am ready with scare marks.
Yeah, and some of this compliance-related, I like that phrase as well, compliance-related training and socialization, let's say technology might be making it thin, that's one pathway, but the other pathway is also where technology is, for the pure compliance ones, also just removing the need for the training and socialization, because to the extent that socialization is about control, you want to control the potential behaviors of this employee, basically. What's happening is, you know, back in the day, you might have trained them around if you're ordering some new goods, you're raising a purchase order, make sure to check if it's a vetted supplier who we've already onboarded. But now with technology, you can't raise a purchase. There's no physical purchase order. You're raising it on your system, SAP, Oracle, whatever. And you can't raise it unless from a drop-down list, you select a pre-vetted, pre-boarded supplier. And so the control is achieved algorithmically without caring whether this person is trained to go through this protocol or not. It's the only way you can achieve that process in your organization. So there's also an element in which technology is just taking over, is doing the control as opposed to needing to train people into certain pathways of behavior.
Yeah, that also spurred a thought about some of the challenges with using technology, in that it takes so much effort to put together the module. But if it's on a topic where you do have significant changes of protocol, but it's too expensive to redo the training module, then you end up with a module that everybody knows is 3 years, 5 years out of date by the time they've had their fourth or fifth time going through it. And that raises cynicism. And I think maybe there's something to be discussed about the attitudinal approaches toward this type of training. Has it changed over time? Because perhaps in the SNAFU days, it was so novel, it was not really something anybody thought about, and it was part of a, you know, attached to some film release and that sort of thing, and it wasn't so bothersome. But now that, because a lot of this type of these types of activities are a natural part of organizational life, I know for myself, I approach it with a certain dose of cynicism. It's like, oh, I got to do this, my annual penance benefit of being in the organization kind of a thing. I still do it. You know, I mean, I don't have a problem doing it, but your heart sinks when I start, because it is a thing you have to do. And I wonder if that by itself, if that's just, if it's avoidable.
Ironically, the one place where I can think of in today's world where we see the most actual attitude-based socialization or training rather than information-based is not in training humans, but in training AI and large language models, where the, you know, people like Anthropic, etc., are, you know, the knowledge the model will learn, but what they are actively trying to do, and Anthropic specifically uses a mechanism called constitutional AI, which is to dictate the constitution of this brain, so that it has a certain attitude, let's say in the case of Snafu, an attitude of caution, as opposed to dictating specifics of, oh, there shouldn't be mud in your gun or whatever, specific knowledge. That's something we actually see in the domain of LLM development nowadays.
I mean, my mind went to a different space, but it's very interesting, by the way. More in terms of, besides the cynicism and the compliance-oriented things and the more, let's say, operational type of training that may exist, there is also a layer of training that has come because organizations, they have to deal with a variety of issues. There is a variety of pressures on them. So they're, you know, they have a goal. Let's stay with NASA, putting the man on the moon. But they also have to think in terms of being cyber secure. Also, in some situations and moments, you know, thinking in terms of maybe diversity, or they may think about safety in general, or what else we can think, you know, all sorts of sustainability, right? So it's all, and I think that the way in which such concerns get translated in practice is, okay, let's offer a training on that, right? and there's, of course, research by, you know, I was just thinking about, I think there is a paper exactly by Dobbin and Califf that says sexual harassment programs and those trainings, they tend to not work, right? And what can be done about that, and different types of training, what assumptions behind that, how to incorporate that. And I was thinking about, you know, Rahim gave many examples about cybersecurity in my own organization. I think what is interesting is that they have this kind of fake phishing emails. And if you fall into them, then you get the 1 minute video, which, as we said, you know, like Rahim was saying, is kind of more comical and light. But you understand the purpose because you almost fell, right? It was a warning in a way. Then it's contextualized in the work, right? So there is one feature I would pull out that makes training more meaningful, right? The other one, of course, and I think that this is for sexual harassment, is also what assumption you have about the person given the training. Is it this kind of blank slate, I just wanted to de-responsabilize myself, or is the one that I want to start on what the person already understands and exists and try to see and build? I mean, it's harder to do than a standardized training that you say ABC that is automatic, but something that is more trying to educate, really, right? So to acknowledge what is the perspectives, opinions, awareness that someone may have and build from that up. And I'm sure we can keep thinking, right? What would make training more meaningful? Thinking back on Snafu and the prevalence of this organizational mechanism to make people aware about policies, make them operate in a certain way, make them embody some values, that does not to be the one that seems to be so prevalent.
Yeah, you raise a great question. You know, what would make this training more meaningful? And not just being more thoughtful about what training actually has to be required versus what really doesn't, what, you know, maybe what can be removed. And I was just wrestling with the question of, is it better to have the expert deliver the message, or is it better to have the message delivered in the best form? Because I've even run into that question myself with the same topic. If I've attended a training session on a particular topic in a large auditorium where the expert is standing in front, and when I mean expert, somebody who is established and understands the material back and forth or whatever, you run the risk of sometimes that expert is very dynamic, very engaging, very good, tells stories, provides experiences, and makes it relatable. And then there are others who simply read PowerPoint slides on the screen, who is knowledgeable but doesn't, anyway, you understand what I mean. It's almost so contextually dependent on who, on how, and perhaps even on the situation unfolding. Like, obviously, when the Me Too movement became a big deal, it was because training and all of this stuff that was being done against to try to stop, curb sexual harassment and sexual assault was not working. And so we had a lot of flurry of action that was in response to that to get more training and better training and whatever. But, you know, sometimes a crisis will spur or make training more meaning just situationally.
But yeah, Tom, to your point about the situation, I think correct. So one is if, you know, if you were in Japan after the Fukushima nuclear disaster or I guess Boeing today, they might take safety training in a very different light than if it was more for hypothetical. What happened with the Snafu videos is it was a lot of scenarios. And so then having a character or a story really helps. And to your point about what if the expert is in the room, you still need the story element, like which was implicit in what you said as well. So it depends on whether the expert can weave a story. So if this is special ops training and you have someone who was on a mission and something went wrong and that person is now in front of you in a good narrative way saying what happened, that will stay vividly in people's minds. Because this is, again, the story element, it seems to me that, you know, you need either the story element or a direct simulation. So to the example of Pedro and like the phishing emails where you are told to click if it's okay or not, and you realize you almost make a mistake. Of course, the military is a place that does a lot of simulation based training as well. And so it's, I think one is direct simulation, the other is stories with characters, whether in the flesh or animated.
You know, what I'm also thinking is that, because, you know, we talked about technology before, and not to be too much Luddite about it, but I think that also it shows the limits of automation, right? Because one could say that, yes, a chatbot can just do this, give you the information that you have to do. And it can be helpful. Maybe you can imagine, as you're going through email, there could be some warnings that are automatized. You know, are you sure you want to click that link? Stuff like this, that's certainly going to be helpful. But I think that it also runs into limits the minute we think about meaningfulness in terms of education as part of training, because what seems to be so powerful from what we can grasp from these shorts, and of course we don't have real data to see how they were perceived or how they were impactful and how they were understood, but it seems there was a lot of effort in terms of the context of the language that would fit that audience, right, that we talk about in the beginning, the kind of people that grew up with comic books in that time, from the stereotypes used to the very, you know, visual imaginary that was common to those folks, the content that seems to fit what are the important both direct policies but also values in the military, the overall scenario in which people were embedded in terms of collective effort and the way it was using, as I said before, certain mechanisms that are common to, you know, railing up people and scaling up, as Raheem said, messages that make them so significant versus if you were stationed somewhere and there was just, as you're going through your screen, just a chatbot saying, okay, this is the thing I have to remember. Remember, tight lips. Right, versus getting through all of contextually rich kind of message.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.